Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer in Patients with ALK and ROS Rearrangements, a special program focused on recently published and emerging clinical research. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ross Kamage from the University of Colorado in Denver, and in addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component with Dr. Kamage's presentation. To begin, Dr. Kamage discussed first-line therapy of metastatic ALK-rearranged non-small cell lung cancer.
So the pressing question now is, somebody with advanced ALK-positive lung cancer walks through the door, and what are you going to start them on? And in 2019, we essentially had two drugs. Sure, we had crizotinib license. Sure, we had ceritinib license, but they haven't really carried through. Because what we had was, we had two studies that were head-to-head against crizotinib. We had the studies with alectinib, of which Alex is the best known, and then we had the study with brigatinib, which was called ALTA-1L. And the amazing thing was, even though alectinib and brigatinib in the post-crizotinib setting look very different, brigatinib has nearly double the median PFS, in the first-line setting, they appeared essentially identical in terms of their relative benefit compared to crizotinib. And the assumption was that your cancer is a bit more pluripotential at the beginning. You put a few more roadblocks in the way and it just doesn't care. It just finds a way around it. So whatever your efficacy endpoint was, whether it was investigator or IRC or point estimate or hazard ratio or landmark analysis, they were almost exactly the same for alectinib and brigatinib. The only thing that was different was the median point estimate for the investigator-assessed progression-free survival, which looked better for alectinib, but in reality, these things look the same. So we had a head-to-head choice, and then because brigatinib has activity post-alectinib, and there's not very much data of alectinib post-brigatinib, then I tended to use alectinib as my first-line choice. And then 2020 happened, and it all got a little shaken up. So we had a third drug, which is not yet licensed, called ensartinib, that went head-to-head against crizotinib in the XL3 study. That looked exactly the same again. I mean, the data is remarkably consistent. Maybe that wasn't a big surprise. In the post-crizotinib setting, ensartinib looks very similar to alectinib. I think its role, if any, might be if it's priced differently in different parts of the world, maybe it might have a market gain there. But it's not changing the biology or the mindset in any way. At ESMO 2020, we had the lorlatinib data, the CROWN data, come out. Now, lorlatinib's a different drug. It's a so-called third-generation inhibitor. It looks structurally very different. It has a somewhat broader range of activity against ALK resistance mutations than even brigatinib, and it has quite phenomenal CNS penetration, which probably brings with it some of its side effects. And then suddenly, the hazard ratio was not the kind of 0.47, 0.51 that we'd been seeing in these other studies. It was 0.28. And you go, wow, this is different. And yet, if you speak to most of the ALK physicians around the world, there's a little bit of hesitancy about instantaneously jumping on board and saying lorlatinib should be the first-line drug for everybody. And there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One is, where do we go next? And then the other is, what price are we paying in terms of side effects for that hazard ratio?
I was going to actually ask you, do you think there's any role for ensartinib that would justify its FDA approval? I mean, in general, you know, we like to have multiple options. You bring up the potential cost situation. Do you think it's going to be approved? And I mean, do you think it'll be an equivalent choice?
I mean, I think if the company that makes ensartinib were to pursue an FDA approval, they would get an approval. They've checked all of the right boxes, but it's not going to get any penetration into the market unless they dramatically sort of undercut it in terms of price. And that can be a differentiator. We've gone from an oncology setting where we had one drug because whatever we had was better than nothing and certain death, to now drugs where we have choices and smaller differences. How many pills you take a day? What are the side effects? What is the cost? Might be differentiators in this new, brave new world.
Another question is the issue of indirect comparison of data. Do most pulmonary investigators look at the lorlatinib first-line data and agree that as an indirect, which has a lot of hazards, that it clearly is better?
So, as I said, you can get into the why does the CROWN data look like it does, and you can get into the what do we do with the data. So, in terms of the why, if you look at something like the one-year progression-free survival rate, you can see that the lorlatinib arm does about 10% better than we've seen with most of these other drugs. So, that looks like real benefit. But the hazard ratio is, of course, a comparator. And you can also see that the crizotinib arm does about 10% worse than we would expect. So that's obviously going to make the hazard ratio look a little bit better than perhaps it does in the real world. But there is a genuine benefit here. I don't honestly know whether it's to do with this slightly expanded mutation coverage. I still believe the cancer is fairly pluripotential. It will find a way around it. Maybe it's going to have to use second drivers earlier. I think a lot is to do with the incredible CNS penetration of lorlatinib. If you look at the hazard ratio by those who have baseline brain metastases, it's 0.2. Now, that's pretty amazing to begin with, although to be honest, that's actually not that different from brigatinib in the same setting. So I actually don't think the 0.28 hazard ratio of the whole study is driven by the brain metastases. What I think is most remarkable is the hazard ratio in those who don't have baseline brain metastases, where the hazard ratio is something like 0.32. Bear in mind, that's like 0.4s up to 0.6s with some of these other drugs. And I really wonder whether lorlatinib's efficacy in the brain is so amazing that in the setting of an intact blood-brain barrier, it actually can get in and really nail CNS prevention better than some of these other drugs. And if you actually look, it was a really nice curve that Ben Solomon presented. He actually said it's not really a curve because it's a flat line in terms of CNS progression, and there's none. Whereas even if you look at alectinib or brigatinib and those without baseline brain metastases, there's not much CNS progression, but there's still about 10%. And maybe that's the 10% improvement that we're seeing in that one-year PFS rate. None of this matters. I mean, this is all kind of like, you know, what you talk about over coffee. The real question is, what do you do with the data?
In terms of what do you do, I guess a big question is sequencing. And I'm going to ask you about that in a second in terms of how you sequence, how you bring in evaluation of resistance mutations. So we can talk about that. Before we get into that, I would like to just get out on the table some of the toxicity issues, because they're going to be a consideration, and I know they're part of your algorithm. So the first I want to ask you about is the brigatinib pulmonary reaction. If you could describe what it is, let me know what you do about it, and how big a deal is it for you?
So each of these drugs have got sort of relatively some common side effects, but each has their own kind of individual blemishes. So the thing with the brigatinib is about somewhere between 3 and 6% of people, so a very small proportion, will get symptomatic shortness of breath within the first few days of going on the drug, what's called early onset pulmonary events. It's not the pneumonitis that you see with any TKI sort of weeks or months down the line. So A, it's much more rapid. And the other thing is if you stay on the drug, it will disappear by about day 5 or day 7. Now, this initially was kind of, you know, your worst possible side effect, you know, severe and unpredictable, like playing Russian roulette. What has now come out is we totally understand it a lot more. In some data that came out at ASCO 2020, something like 9 out of 10 people, if you actually do pulmonary function tests, will have a brief few days drop in their DLCO, their ability to transfer gas in their lungs, by about 10 to 20%. And then it gets better despite continued exposure to the drug. In that particular study, not a single patient had symptoms. And I think what this is telling us is it happens in everybody. The 3 to 6% of people who have symptoms are the people who can't tolerate that short-lived, modest drop in their DLCO before recovery. Then it's much less scary because you just look at the patient in front of you, and if Mrs. Jones had a pulmonary embolism and new oxygen requirement last week, she's the one that you're probably going to be a bit hesitant about. To be honest, even then it's not a deal breaker because we know that you can sneak up on it. If you actually do 30 milligrams for 3 days, 60 milligrams for 3 days, 90 milligrams for 3 days, and then up to 180, even the sickest patient can tolerate brigatinib. You just need a slower step up.
When you do the step up, I don't know if this has been done. Have they looked at pulmonary functions to see if that changes them?
We haven't. We kind of have the clinical observation. I think there was a patient actually of MJ's in Florida who was on the intensive care unit, and he did this slow step up. And they had no respiratory issues at all.
Wow, this must have been an interesting story. What do you think the pathophysiology is, the mechanism? What's going on? Is it like some kind of allergic, inflammatory thing?
It's a good question. In that study at ASCO 2020, we did look at what's called CyTOF analysis, looking for some inflammatory markers. I don't know that we've really nailed it. I mean, there was some evidence that some degree of immune activation beforehand. So I suspect it's some kind of degranulation, something that happens. and you get a little bit of inflammation and then it just gets better by itself. So that was a hand-waving answer because I don't know.
You know, I've also, in terms of alectinib, I always had this vision that it was just so perfectly tolerated. And yet I've heard a couple of cases with people had significant problems. What are some of the issues when you do encounter problems with alectinib?
You introduced the idea that, you know, when we're trying to make a decision about the patient in front of us, we're really applying kind of average toxicity data to them. But an individual can have different toxicities. So yes, some people can get arthralgia. Some people can get terrible photosensitive skin, almost like a burning reaction. Some people can get edema. And so it comes down to having choices is good. You probably go in with the one that is best tolerated in most people, and then you adapt.
So what about ensartinib? Toxicity profile like alectinib? Anything unusual there?
So its unique feature is it causes a rash. It's the only ALK inhibitor that really causes much of a rash. Nobody has any idea why. It's not a kind of acne rash. It's just kind of there. It's not a deal breaker. It's pretty well tolerated. It's a bit sort of alectinib-like.
So curious about lorlatinib. Heard some pretty wild stories about psychiatric things and personality changes, et cetera. Can you talk about what's been seen with this drug?
So lorlatinib is a different beastie, and I think that's why there's this pause for thought. I mean, I think if lorlatinib was a really well-tolerated drug, the crown would be a no-brainer. It's like, hey, we'll figure out what we do next later. That's next year's or next 4 or 5 years issue. Just because you use up your nth-line drug first, that just becomes a new challenge. I think the pause is actually to do with the tolerability. Now, of course, you can have people who tolerate lorlatinib completely fine. But I have to tell you, based on my experience, that is the minority of patients. I think the dose reduction rate is, which wasn't reported in Ben Solomon's presentation, but we understand is running about 20%, is probably not capturing that. So in terms of the side effects of lorlatinib, something like 70% of patients are going to have abnormalities in their triglycerides or cholesterol. We don't know the mechanism. But this isn't just a lab abnormality. These go up to the levels where you have to intervene. And so actually, it's something like 70% of patients actually have to go onto a statin or a triglyceride-lowering agent or some combination thereof. It's really interesting. So in some countries, if they were doing the health economic assessment, they would actually have to factor in the idea that 70% of people need to go on a statin. This is the new world. But there are other side effects. Weight gain. Now, if Thanksgiving comes up and we all put on a little bit of weight, that's not a big deal. But we're talking about grade 3 weight gain in 20% of people. That's a 20% increase in your weight. Patients physically transform in front of you. And about another 20% will have a lower degree of weight gain. You've got peripheral neuropathy. But I think the one that most people are concerned about are the higher CNS function issues. Now, the way they present it, they've tended to split it out into different categories, which makes it look more innocent than it is. So cognitive side effects, maybe 20%. Mood side effects, maybe about 20%. Speech slowing doesn't even appear on their description. That's probably about 5% of people. If you add all of those things together, my guess is about 50% of people, even in the first line, are getting some degree of mood or thinking alteration. Sometimes the patient doesn't think anything's wrong. And you get into this very weird, are we being too paternalistic? But what happens if the spouse is saying they're not the same person? Who do you listen to?
Yeah, really amazing. So what about dose reduction? Does that help?
Absolutely. I mean, these are completely reversible. And, you know, I've had patients who were, you know, you can find scare stories of people who become, you know, completely psychotic and you stop the drug and a few days later they're better. I think one of the most insightful comments actually came from Gina Hollenbeck, who's the president of the ALK Positive Patient Association. And she had very bad side effects at the standard 100 milligram dose. She dropped down to 75 milligrams and it was much more tolerable. But if you speak to Gina, she would say, but it's still not normal. Okay, she's still more irritable. She's had to see a psychologist. She's had to see a psychiatrist. She's had to go on medication. That's what I mean by the dose reduction rate doesn't necessarily capture it because you have to plug in all these supportive care. Gina actually says, you know, lorlatinib needs a prescription of a psychologist with it.
Wow, really interesting. So again, I kind of want to get you to start talking about sequencing, but one more thing I want to bring up because I never heard it and I thought it was really great. this paper that you did that really opened my eyes to a completely new issue about toxicity reporting and dose. And maybe you can just kind of talk. I never really thought about it. It makes complete sense, but I think it's really an important point. Can you talk a little bit about that paper and kind of what you concluded?
So Emily Simons was Master of Public Health, who's now moved to medical oncology, and she's now a trainee here. And she was sitting in my clinic, and we started to talk about how we're making more and more decisions based on early phase data. So for example, you know, lorlatinib would be a great example. If it's sitting in the clinic or in the pharmacy for some other reason, and now we have data in our disease type, we might see phase one data. And the question is, how is that data being presented on toxicity? There is zero standardization. And what Emily did was she pulled something like 200 or 300 abstracts and presentations from ASCO and thoracic oncology over the last few years and started to look at it. And we actually come up with a checkpoint of about 10 different issues which could be standardized. But one really interesting thing is, if there's a dose escalation element to your phase one study, is when you present the adverse events, do you present it just at the recommended phase two dose, or do you present it across all dose levels, essentially diluting out your tox signal by everyone who got the lower dose? And that seems to be relatively commonly done. And so, again, when we're trying to apply average toxicity data to the patient in front of us, we need to know that it's done at the dose that we're talking about. The other one we mentioned, and lorlatinib we actually pulled out as an example, is sometimes you'll present data based on this happened in 10% or 15% or 20% of patients, and we don't present the lower stuff. If I fragment toxicity down into subgroups, everything falls below that cut point. So the analogy one might use is, let's say your drug causes color vision abnormality in 50% of people, but I present it as yellow color vision abnormality and orange color vision abnormality. Now everybody has 5% and I don't present it. So there are little deliberate or accidental sleights of hand in terms of the way these data are presented.
And so, you know, we go to people like you to sort of distill it out, which is what you've been doing up to now in this talk. Now I want to talk about sequencing in these patients. And it sounds like, I mean, of course, the journey is going to be a little bit different based on where the disease is, prior history. There are so many different factors, resistance, mutations. But can you kind of talk a little bit about the way you sequence agents in ALK disease and sort of how it varies based on site of metastasis, how patients doing, resistance mutations, et cetera?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things is, you know, I gave a talk to the ALK positive patient group a few months ago, and they asked me to talk on what hope looks like. And what I did was to try and explain where we were 10 years ago and where we are now, because nobody believes the future can actually occur. But if you look at, you know, how much progress we've made, I mean, 10 years ago, if you were a 20-year-old diagnosed with lung cancer, everyone went, wow, that's really unusual. And then you usually died incredibly rapidly, and we never knew why. We now know that the majority of those people might have ALK or some other driver oncogene. We now have multiple drugs. We now know about using local ablative therapy. We now know which chemotherapies work. And the reason we're talking about, hey, why do we have a pause for thought about lorlatinib in the first line setting, is because even if the median progression-free survival, which is not yet mature, but let's imagine the median progression-free survival is something amazing. Let's imagine it's 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. These people might live 10 years. And so the time on a less well-tolerated drug, if it doesn't change your overall time on this earth, may have to be factored in. So what we're looking for in the journey is optimal control of disease with minimal side effects. And when we published our data that Jose Pacheco, one of our junior faculty, presented a few years ago, amazingly enough, your median overall survival in our center was close to 7 years. And it didn't matter by the year in which you were diagnosed. You go, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you have to understand that if you were diagnosed in certain years, you only had crizotinib. If you were diagnosed in later years, you had crizotinib and next generation inhibitors. And if you were diagnosed later years, you had even third generation inhibitors. And it didn't matter, because this is a forgiving disease and you can play catch up later. And so PFS in the first line setting is really just the time to the next treatment decision. It's not necessarily the same as how long you're going to be alive. And so we have to think about it in a different way. So in terms of sequencing, I do have some pause for thought with lorlatinib as the first-line drug, because maybe I'm delaying the time to the next treatment decision, but I'm paying a price in terms of side effects. But one of the analogies I'm a little hesitant about bringing up, but I want to introduce it, is the idea of whole brain radiotherapy. So we know that if you have brain metastases and you have whole brain radiotherapy as opposed to stereotactic radiosurgery, your time to the next CNS treatment decision is way longer. And yet we know we pay a price for it. There was a great study by Paul Brown that was published in JAMA in 2016 that looked exactly at that. Everyone got SRS, and you either did or didn't get whole brain radiotherapy on top. The hazard ratio for intracranial progression for whole brain radiotherapy was 0.27. But we also knew we paid a price in terms of cognitive side effects. I'm kind of thinking about lorlatinib in that way, that sure, I'm going to use it at some point, but when I really need to.
So if you walk through the door now, in my practice, I'm going to start you on alectinib. And the reason being is there are people who will have years of control, and in most people, it's going to be pretty well tolerated. Now, if you choose to do brigatinib, that's fine. If you choose to do lorlatinib, that's fine too. The only reason I'm making that decision is for lorlatinib, I think we're taking on a lot more in the way of side effects from the get-go, and I don't know in the long run whether that's justified. Maybe you can play catch-up later. For brigatinib, I tend to keep it in reserve because I think it's a very well-tolerated drug that will work on almost as many mutations as lorlatinib in the post-alectinib setting. So I kind of keep it in my back pocket, even though that's not technically its license. So let's say you put someone on alectinib. They do great. And then when they progress, the first question you've got to ask is this something I can just zap with radiotherapy and keep them on the drug? We know we can sometimes double the median progression-free survival when we do that. That can be in the body, that can be in the brain. Let's imagine that's not feasible, and now you're faced with choosing a different drug. So in that setting, in an ideal world, and it's not an ideal world, but in an ideal world, you would find out the mechanism of resistance. So your choice isn't just based on the numbers, it's based on personalizing it to your patient. Sure, you can look in the blood and maybe you see something, but if you don't see something in the blood, you have to do a tissue biopsy. The first thing you're looking for is an ALK mutation, because then you know it's going to be about choosing a different ALK inhibitor. You can look at a table and you can choose again the one that's likely to work and that in your experience is best tolerated. As I said, there's a paper recently published with brigatinib showing a 40% response rate in that setting, lorlatinib a 45% response rate. We've also seen studies where brigatinib has a 17% response rate or a 70% response rate. What does this mean? It means none of these drugs work in everybody. It depends on who you're giving it to. If you know what the mutation is, that response rate will go up. But the elephant in the room is some of these people don't have on-target resistance mutations. They have second drivers. So make sure that when you're re-biopsying, you're doing that broad panel again. We now know that some of the things that we think are driver oncogenes in other tumor types can be co-drivers here. RET has been described. MET fusions, MET exon 14, and particularly MET amplification have all been described. And there you add in a MET inhibitor. Nothing licensed, you're going off label, but it works. And then if none of those things work, then you're talking about adding in pemetrexed-based chemotherapy. And I deliberately say add in, because I tend to keep the TKI going, especially if the patient has brain metastases, because you're controlling that part of the body, and I don't want to take that away. Now, that ALK TKI, the last one, has to be well-tolerated. If you've just put them on a drug and they're having a horrible time, I'd probably switch them back to the last well-tolerated one and still add in the chemotherapy.
All right, well, let's move over and talk a little bit about ROS1. You actually, in your talk, presented a 37-year-old woman, a never-smoker, who presented back in 2013 with shortness of breath. She had bone and liver mets. Her MRI was negative, and she was found in a liver biopsy to have a ROS1 by FISH. She got, in 2013, crizotinib, did really well. And then in August 2015, and then in 2018, solitary CNS mets, and treated with SRS and continues to be treated. Can you talk a little bit about that case and where we are today with ROS1 and in particular choice of TKI?
So yeah, we know that crizotinib, if anything, is an even better ROS1 inhibitor than it is an ALK inhibitor. And yet the median PFS for crizotinib in the ROS1 studies jumps around the place. And one of the reasons may be that we know that one of the liabilities of crizotinib is it's not very good at getting into the brain.
And so maybe those studies vary in terms of the proportion of patients with brain metastases or the proportion with undertreated brain metastases by radiation. The other drug which is licensed in the first-line setting is entrectinib. And to be honest, what entrectinib brings to the party is it has CNS penetration. It has a CNS response rate in ROS1 patients of about a 55%. If you look at the median progression-free survival, it's certainly looking like the best of the crizotinib studies, perhaps because it's sort of neutralizing the effect of brain metastases to some extent. But even if you look in those studies, the median PFS for those with brain metastases is still shorter for entrectinib than it is for those without brain metastases. So it's not a perfect CNS drug. It's just better than crizotinib. And I think it's reasonably well tolerated. You've got some dizziness, some taste alteration with it, but it's not a deal breaker. And whilst guidelines like the NCCN, which will list everything, will list both, some of the pathways like the Elsevier clinical pathway, for example, which is very much a kind of footpath rather than a freeway, will just list one. And they've tended to list entrectinib because they feel like, well, at least it's got the CNS aspect in there. And probably that's what I would start a patient on these days.
Your patient, then, maybe you might have started entrectinib?
Yeah. And if I went back in the time machine and I had access to it, that's probably what I'd do.
And how about when she developed the CNS mets? Again, when that happened, if entrectinib was revealed, would you have switched her to entrectinib? Would you have held off on the SRS?
So I think that's a great question. I mean, I think if they were only progressing in the brain, I think a change to entrectinib would totally be reasonable with close observation and SRS as salvage as needed. I think the issue is if they were progressing in the brain and the body, that's probably not the right thing to do because the entrectinib isn't bringing anything to the game outside of the brain.
Interesting. I guess one other issue then would be the tolerability issues with entrectinib. And also, I'm kind of curious if you could reflect back on the tolerability of crizotinib. It's interesting when I talk to general medical oncologists, I'm sure the same thing with investigators, and you ask about ALK cases, they'll have a bunch of people who started out on crizotinib, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago and got switched to alectinib. So kind of interesting how you see that evolving in community-based practice. But in terms of tolerability, what do you see with entrectinib? What do you see with crizotinib?
So crizotinib certainly is the devil we know. It's not free from side effects. I think, again, we have to look at it in the context. When it was first developed, our alternative was chemotherapy, so it seemed like a walk in the park. I think we've figured out the nausea issue, tend to take it with food. It still can cause some issues in terms of diarrhea or constipation in some people. And I think probably the most problematic side effect with it is peripheral edema. It's to do with its MET activity. And that's a cumulative late onset side effect. And that's probably its biggest issue. Entrectinib doesn't have any MET activity. It doesn't tend to have that as an issue, but it has some NTRK activity. It's also licensed for NTRK rearranged lung cancer. And that brings with it the dizziness and the taste disturbance, but it's not a deal breaker for most people. Neither of these is meeting our goal, which is perfect control of disease and zero side effects, but they're edging towards it.
So in your talk, which I recommend people to check out, you had a slide that sounded really interesting, but I didn't exactly understand it. Maybe you can explain it to me verbally, I'll understand better. But you had inhibition of ROS1 KDMs by TKIs, and then you have this other thing about exposure, which it sounds interesting.
Yes, let me try and explain. So the way I think about it is sometimes we have, you know, you see people and they give talks and they want to have a picture. So they flash up a slide and they don't really understand it either. That's okay. You know, I think one of the things that we're talking about here is we have suddenly, you know, in a true translational medicine way, we've started to see cell lines with different mutations being presented with different drugs. And one of the ways that these were initially presented, ALK was the first field that did it, is like, you know, they love the color coding. Because we can say, you know, red's bad, green's good. But the question is, how do you do the color coding? The initial ways they did it was literally based on the IC50, the concentration that inhibited 50% of growth of these cell lines. But that doesn't matter, okay? You can have somebody with an IC50 of 1 or an IC50 of 1,000, but if your exposure of the drug is 10,000, they're both drowned. It doesn't matter. So the way I'm showing you this one is actually a much nicer way of presenting it, which takes into account the IC50 and the exposure. And what they're doing is the average concentration. That's the CAV that they're taking. And by factoring the ratio of those two things, that color coding now looks a lot more like a prediction of whether Mrs. Jones is going to respond, whether the exposure in Mrs. Jones is enough to inhibit that mutation. So that's why I like the way it's presented.
So, for example, you have red for less than 5. So when you see that, you know they have a relatively low exposure, and so it's going to be more relevant. But then if it's higher, you know, you compare it to what it takes to kill the cell. Is that the way you look at it?
Yeah, because what you can see is you can see two cells with different drugs that appear to have a different IC50, but they might be coded the same because it's to do with the exposure.
Right. Got it.
What you can see from it is there are different ROS1 resistance mutations to crizotinib that entrectinib doesn't really add anything, but lorlatinib covers some, but not all. And the most common resistance mutation, which is called G2032R, which can be somewhere between 20 to 40% of cases, isn't sensitive to lorlatinib. And so one of the things I often see in second opinions is somebody who's ROS1 and they progress and they just start throwing ROS1 inhibitors at them. So they start throwing entrectinib and lorlatinib and ceritinib. And if they're blowing through all of these, what it's really telling you is either they have a mutation that none of these drugs cover, and you could biopsy and prove that, or 50% of cases have got a second driver. It's nothing to do with ROS1 anymore. And that's where you need to re-biopsy and look for these metas in there, but you know, a whole bunch of other things are being described.
This G2032R mutation, is there anything that hits it? What about repotrectinib?
So repotrectinib, what used to be called TPX0005, is the only drug so far that clinically has generated much data on that. Data set is relatively small, about 7 patients with proven G2032R with about a 40% response rate. Now, I think they're wanting to take this drug to the first line. I don't know if that's a brilliant idea. Certainly, I think it would have a niche indication in the proven G2032R. But that's, again, is it the right drug for everybody? No. If you have G2032R as your mechanism of resistance, I would seek it out in a clinical trial in a heartbeat.
Interesting. So I just want to finish with a few of your thoughts. You're talking about hope and kind of looking towards the future. And I'm curious, particularly in terms of lung cancer, both in terms of targeted therapy and other strategies, of course, checkpoint inhibitors, what are some of the things you're most excited about? You were talking about your historical perspective on targeted therapy, but if you think about immunotherapy, I think we've only been using it like 5 or 6 years. I mean, it's amazing. I've got general medical oncologists. The most common question they have nowadays is, should I stop? Can you imagine if a strategy wasn't even out there 5 or 6 years ago? Now you got a bunch of people, oncologists, are saying, oh, can I stop it at some point? I'm just kind of curious for your perspective in general on lung cancer over the last 10 or 15 years. Of course, we saw the ADORA data, which really has pushed the targeted therapy into a whole new arena in terms of what you see as some of the major things that have happened and what you think might happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're starting to do, certainly in the field of targeted therapies, is flesh out the horizons of where new research needs to go. I mean, we know with every targeted therapy, you're going to get on-target resistance mutations. That's fine. That's not, they just need to be discovered, but it's not a big surprise. I would suggest there are 3 broad horizons we need to start to think about. So one is, what are these second drivers? You know, we've nailed on-target resistance mechanisms. As we mentioned before, some of these ways of turning on pathways to drive acquired resistance aren't done through classical mutations or gene rearrangements or amplification. That's going to be the next way. You know, how can you turn on a pathway and find it in a mechanism that we can? The second thing is to start to kind of, you know, almost step back. We now know for ALK, if we use that as an example, that sure, the average control might be measured in years. But there are still people progressing before that median. We know that in ALK, there's a high-risk group. We don't know why. We know it's probably to do with having P53. It may be to do with the variant if you have EML4 ALK. But why? Why are they progressing in different parts of the body? Do they have specific mechanisms of acquired resistance? So defining the higher-risk group that may need different therapies up front, as opposed to just giving that to everybody, is going to be one of the next areas. And the last one is the invisible elephant in the room, which we've been talking about for a while, which is you put people on these targeted therapies. They have an amazing response. But before they progress, if you were to stop the drug, their cancer would grow. So there's stuff which is still sensitive to the drug, suppressed, but not actively growing. That persistent state remains to be isolated and discovered. There was a very interesting paper in Cell earlier this year trying to characterize the inducible signals that was a kind of like an intensive care unit for keeping these cancer cells alive, you know, in the setting of the drug. If we can figure out what those are and attack those, maybe we can get to 100% cell kill, and that's a cure.
Any thoughts about how we can do that and mechanism to do it? What do you think about combinations of other types of therapies, checkpoint inhibitors, et cetera?
So let me come back to that. So what they looked at, and it was led by Trevor Bavona's group, is they found something which they called an alveolar cell signaling or alveolar cell profile. So again, not classic mutations, but induction of transcripts that could somehow keep these cells alive. So if we start to define new targets, then maybe our treatment is not about looking for stuff that drives acquired resistance a year down the line, but purging these. And you could have a treatment that would be horribly toxic. It doesn't matter. Maybe you only need to give it for a short period of time to kill this 1 in 1,000 cells. You mentioned immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is both a tremendous success and I think a big dose of reality. Here we are, you know, nearly 7 years from the first time PD-1 or PD-L1 agents came out in lung cancer. So the issue with immunotherapy is, you know, we have these tremendous successes, PD-1, PD-L1, and yet we haven't built on that. You can argue about whether CTLA-4 with ipi-nivo is really a step forward or not. I'm not entirely sure it is. But I think one of the biggest issues is we have all these other checkpoints. We don't know who to give them to. We're still trying to give them to everybody. We really need to bring personalized medicine into immunotherapy.
Well, also, you know, immunotherapy is not just checkpoint inhibitors. There are a lot of immune modulators out there. Your thought that these people might be progressing through some non-mutation mechanism, that's kind of what made me think that you get into the whole immune system, you know, cytokines, et cetera. Maybe it's something different than a checkpoint mechanism that might be helpful. I don't know.
So one of the really interesting things is if you take any of these other immune modulators, immune checkpoints, and look at them in the post PD-1 setting, they all have about a 5% response rate. So when you think that, you know, it's not just from the PD-1 backbone that they're being added into. So it tells you it works, but unless you know who that 5% are, you can't develop these drugs. So it's a bit like having a targeted therapy and we don't know who it's working in. That's where we are with immunotherapy, taking it beyond PD-1 and PD-L1.
What about the strategy of combining chemotherapy and targeted therapy? We're seeing that looked at in EGFR. There's maybe some hints that's going to be useful. What are your thoughts?
So the idea of adding in either an antiangiogenic or adding in cytotoxic chemotherapy or something is interesting. It certainly seems to prolong the PFS. There's even, at least in some studies, a suggestion that there's an improvement in overall survival. And yet it's not terribly palatable. I think figuring out who the higher risk people are up front might make more of a case. If I said, sure, everyone else is going to have 5 years on an ALK inhibitor and you're going to have 9 months, maybe you'd say, okay, give me the chemo. So I think fragmenting even a molecularly driven subtype into higher and lower risk will make that more palatable.
Flipping back to ALK, how do you factor in checkpoint inhibitors in patients with metastatic disease? Can you describe a situation where you would use a checkpoint inhibitor in an ALK patient?
I can. No one. There is not a single reported case anywhere in the world of an ALK-positive patient responding to PD-1 or PD-L1. I do a gazillion second opinions. I have yet to see a case. I've given talks in China and said, I will pay you, you know, a US dollar if you can give me a case. They beam it out to 40,000 people. No one has taken my dollar yet. So everyone is like, you know, what about this one? You go, well, didn't you just irradiate that the week before? Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot about that. I mean, it really, that is not the solution for ALK.
Interesting. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Kamage, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer with ALK and ROS Rearrangements.